to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, let's hear about a programme over on Radio 4.
Books on the BBC.
I see I have alarmed you. Do not be frightened by my beard. I am a lover of America.
An American traveller arrives in Lahore to find a friendly stranger.
Do not look so suspicious. I assure you, sir, nothing untoward will happen to you.
Eager to tell him his intriguing life story.
It is the effect of scarcity. One's rules of propriety make one thirst for the improper.
Mohsin Hamid's The Reluctant Fundamentalist on BBC Radio 4.
Come, tell me, what were you looking for?
Next Monday night at 10:45.
Well, tomorrow evening in the prom, we'll be hearing the world premiere of a concerto by Thomas Lacher. And there's also a prom's composer portrait about him tomorrow evening after the prom at 9:30. That's tomorrow evening. That's here on BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. The time now is 7:30 and we go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom, which is presented by Katie Derham.
Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for an all-Russian programme from the Philharmonia, conducted by their principal conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, and featuring one of the truly great young violinists around, the Georgian-born Lisa Batyashvili. She's going to be playing Shostakovich's first violin concerto, and we'll be hearing her talk about her passionate relationship with the piece a little later on. In the second half tonight, we'll be hearing Stravinsky's revolutionary music from his ballet Petrushka, a work which spawned 1,000 cartoon themes, and then Tchaikovsky's mighty symphonic poem Francesca da Rimini, a tale he took from Dante's Inferno about a strong woman doomed to the second circle of hell for taking a lover. But in the first half, we are sticking with Shostakovich, the violin concerto, as I mentioned, but to start with, his rarely heard Age of Gold suite, music from his first ballet, which he wrote in 1929. Now, at this point, he was the bright young thing of Soviet music, and he was therefore the obvious choice to write the music to a new ballet, which had been commissioned to, I quote, modernize and Sovietize an art form which still felt stuck in its czarist past. Now, the story he was given was, rather incredibly, the tale of a highly virtuous Soviet football team on tour in a Western and corrupt and unnamed capitalist city. And before I tell you a little bit more about that, I should say that is the leader of the Philharmonia, who's just walked on, Zsolt Tihamér-Vizontai, who's just tuning up the orchestra for us now. But back to this rather strange football ballet. Not surprisingly, the high moral values and superhuman sporting strength of the Soviet team triumphs over all sorts of Western decadence. And tonight's conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, described the piece to me earlier.
It's a very raucous piece and very funny, and it's sort of cartoonish. It's very descriptive of the events, and, you know, he paints characters of the fat capitalists with their mollies and their cigars and the sort of ideologically solid football team that even in jail they think of their mothers rather than other more professional females. And I could very well see a sort of a colourful cartoon behind this. And it contains a very famous polka, which is the most skillfully written wrong notes in the history of music.
Well, listen out for that polka. It's in the third of the four movements, but here comes Esa-Pekka Salonen now to conduct the Philharmonia in Shostakovich's The Age of Gold suite.
Yeah.
And so the Soviet footballers prevail amongst all that capitalist depravity. An extremely jolly opening to tonight's from Shostakovich's The Age of Gold Suite, performed with enthusiasm by the Philharmonia, conducted by Esa Pekka-Salonen. He brought various soloists to their feet, including saxophonist Simon Harum and principal trumpet Alistair Mackie, but so many members of the orchestra shining in that performance. Very cheerful crowd here in the Royal Albert Hall, packed again for this all-Russian programme under Esa Pekka-Salonen. Well, in the end, Shostakovich's first attempt at writing for ballet wasn't what you'd call an unqualified success. Apparently, the powers that be thought he was much better at making the story erotic rather than patriotic, and so it was pulled from the stage and banned pretty rapidly. He was going to have to get used to this happening under the Soviet regime. Fast forward 10 years or so, and he'd received one of the most sinister reviews ever written about his Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, in which allegedly Stalin himself wrote, "He better change his musical ways, or else there'd be dire consequences." Effectively writing with a death threat hanging over him, and with he and his fellow composers ruthlessly persecuted, the first violin concerto of 1948 is an extraordinary achievement. A piece in four movements. We start with the powerful, slow nocturne. Then there's a sardonic scherzo, there's profound passacaglia, leading up to an epic cadenzo, which goes into the finale, which Shostakovich calls a burlesque. Well, he had to keep it under wraps until 1955, 2 years after Stalin's death, when it was performed by uber-Soviet violinist David Oistrakh, for whom it had been written. Tonight's soloist, indeed, has a direct link to that great man. Lisa Batyashvili's teacher was taught by Oistrakh, and she, the 32-year-old Georgian who seems to enjoy undiluted praise from critics and fellow violinists alike, feels particularly passionate about the piece.
First of all, it's very challenging to be at the same time psychological about the piece and not give everything already in the first and the second movement and to keep that special tension going on until the end of the piece. And I think when you have achieved that on the stage, it is an incredible feeling, something that I can really not compare to any other concerto, because I don't know any other concerto that has this kind of culmination towards the end of the cadenza where everything is kind of exploding. And I think for every artist, it's a special experience on the stage.
She really is looking forward to tonight's performance. She says the real message of this concerto is that it's telling us a story about what it was like to be alive in Soviet times. Here she comes now, Lisa Batyashvili, coming to the stage with conductor Esa Pekka-Salonen to perform Shostakovich's first violin concerto with the Philharmonia.
Thank you.
Phenomenal performance of Shostakovich's first violin concerto there by Lisa Batyashvili with the Philharmonia, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. And that cadenza, Oistra, for whom it was written, you know, he found it so exhausting, he begged Shostakovich to give him a break. In fact, the composer relented, and that's why the first few bars of the finale are just the orchestra playing. My goodness, though, emotionally exhausting to listen to, let alone for play. It was a breathless, edge-of-the-seat performance, and you can hear the response in the Royal Albert Hall here. Lisa Batyashvili coming back to the stage to take another bow. Described in the New York Times last year as having everything it takes for a major career. Thorough musicianship, virtuosity, charisma, and a lovely stage presence. I think everybody here would agree with that. That concerto, which premiered in 1955, was played at the Proms the very next year, conducted by Malcolm Sargent. The soloist then was Max Rostal. Lisa, born into a very musical family in Georgia, violinist father, pianist mother, coming back onto the stage now with Esa-Pekka Salonen. The two are going to share a huge mutual admiration. Holding hands as they bow again, I suspect we may be getting an encore. Well, maybe we will, but maybe not just yet. She's going off stage again. You know, she was one of the very first batch of BBC Radio 3's New Generation Artists. It was a fine year, a fine selection between 1999 and 2001. Alongside her was Paul Lewis, Natalie Klein, the Belcher Quartet. Well, as this capacity audience stamps its feet and continues to cheer and clap, I really do think she's going to have to give us an encore. She's coming back on stage now with the conductor. Thank you. A little piece of Shostakovich for an encore there from Lisa Batyashvili. That was called A Lyrical Waltz from Seven Dolls Dances, and it was a suite of easy piano pieces compiled in 1953 from Shostakovich's ballet suites. But that particular arrangement was by Lisa's father, Tamash Batyashvili. I mentioned that he was a violinist. He is, in fact, an extremely eminent violinist, longtime member of the Georgian State Quartet. The family left Georgia when her father had an instinct they should move to Europe. The very next day, civil war broke out. A very prescient man, as well as a fine arranger of music. And Lisa's back on stage to take the warm applause of the Philharmonia, as well as the audience here. Wonderful performance tonight. Well, we heard arrangements there of music from ballet suites. We have more ballet in the second half when we'll be hearing Stravinsky's Petrushka, but it is now time for the interval and time to join Susan Hitch discussing Dante for tonight's Proms Plus literary event recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Welcome to this Proms Plus literary event. I'm Susan Hitch, and we'll be talking about Dante, Dante Alighieri, and how he's inspired writers and artists since the 14th century. He was an ambitious young politician as well as a poet. He spent 22 years in political exile from his beloved Florence, and it's possible that without exile he might not have written his huge work, The Divine Comedy. Exile also gave him the anger and that immense energy which rages through the three poems of the comedy, especially the first, Inferno, about his descent into hell. You can recognise the same energy in Tchaikovsky's Francesca di Rimini, symphonic poem which we'll hear in this evening's concert. He wrote it after reading the Whirlwind episode, which we'll be discussing in a minute. Dante's guide for his voyage into hell was Virgil. To guide us into Dante's Inferno and its afterlife, we have with us the academic Margaret Keane, who has a kind of infernal expertise. Her book on the cultural history of hell is coming out next year. And Sarah Dunant's vividly imagined historical novels of Renaissance Florence make her the best kind of guide, who points out not just the grand monuments, but also the sounds and the smells and the sights. And our readings this evening will be performed by the actor Peter Marinka. Please welcome them all now. Margaret, how important was Dante in his own day?
Well, I suppose he's known both as a poet, and that would be as a poet of courtly love up until the writing of the epic. But he's also known as a politician, as you were saying, and a politician that's been embroiled in scandal. So he's actually been on the wrong side of a coup in Florence, and he's had all of his goods seized, and he's been forced into exile. And that particular scandal is going to be a very major part of why you might start reading him.
Why do we read Dante still today, Sarah?
I think there's never a time when it hasn't been read, actually. I mean, when I went to Florence to first start researching my novel set in the end of the 15th century, so that's 2.5 centuries after he writes, everywhere I looked, I slammed into Dante. People were still reading Dante. Botticelli was illustrating Dante. And the first time I went to Florence to do a research trip, I arrived 2 days after the Italian stand-up comedian and satirist Roberto Benigni had packed an open-air piazza, Piazza San Michelangelo, above the city by reading Dante's Inferno in its original Italian to an Italian public. And I once remember going to a tiny, deserted and semi-ruined castle just near Poppi outside Florence, and I needed to get a key to get in there. And an old man, a custodian, came out and brought me the key, and we went in together, and in the church bit, there was an extract from Dante's Purgatory, because this is one of the places he'd been given exile from, one of the counts there, and he'd put the count into purgatory. And with my rather pathetic Italian, I was trying to read it, and as I started to read it, the old man just turned away from the wall and, in fantastic declamatory session, just gave the whole of the extract and then carried on going. through the other cantos in Purgatory, and then at the end of it mourned the fact that more people couldn't do the whole of the Inferno by heart. And that's how powerful he still is today.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of it now. For our first reading, Virgil has led Dante downwards into the Inferno, as far as the second circle of the nine which descend below them. And this circle is for those who've been led astray by their senses. They meet a huge whirlwind. Peter.
And now the sounds of grief begin to fill my ear. I'm come where cries of anguish smite my shrinking sense and lamentation shrill. A place made dumb of every glimmer of light, which bellows like tempestuous ocean, burling in the batter of a two-way wind's buffet and fight. The blast of hell that never rests from whirling harries the spirits along in the sweep of its swath and vexes them for ever beating and hurling. When they are borne to the rim of the ruinous path, with cry and wail and shriek, they are caught by the gust, railing and cursing the power of the Lord's wrath. Into this torment carnal sinners are thrust, so I was told, the sinners who make their reason bond thrall under the yoke of their lust.
Peter, thank you. Margaret, what's the architecture of hell?
Well, it's basically a funnel of ever-decreasing circles. I suppose one of the most important things to realise is that this is supposed to be a conceptual space so that we can think theologically, but it's also a fully realised topography, and with Virgil as our guide, we can expect that it's going to go one better than the Aeneid. So we have these nine levels, as you were saying, these nine circles of hell. Virgil will tell us that the first set of them as we're going down, the wider, less claustrophobic spaces, are there for those who have been incontinent, those who have forgotten to do something, those who have just lacked backbone in some way. And then as we go further down, it's for willed malice. So higher up, we're going to find lust, which we've just been hearing about. Then we'll find gluttony, we'll find avarice, we'll find anger. And then when we go down to malice, to that level of cold-heartedness, we'll find violence, all the sins of violence, all the sins of fraud, which Dante thinks is a particularly human way of behaving, that animals don't behave fraudulently. Whether that's true or not in 21st century terms, couldn't say. And then finally, treachery. That's right at the bottom with the lake of ice.
So we're not really very far in at the second level at all.
No,
why do we meet a whirlwind here?
We meet a whirlwind because these people are restless. In a sense, they have given up reason, which was part of the quotation that we heard so beautifully read there. They are giving themselves over to passion, and now this whirlwind pushes them around. They are light because they have not themselves grounded themselves, either in a better understanding of love, which is partly why this is so early on in the poem, because it's a false love, and we'd better rationalise this, we'd better realise what's wrong here, even if we're sympathetic. So they are caught up in this turbulent space.
In the middle of this whirlwind, Dante sees two of the people there, a man and a woman, bound together so that they can't get apart, and recognises them as contemporaries of his, Francesca di Rimini and Paolo Malatesta. What's going on there?
Well, we're in love, you know, and love is a very big word. Love can be carnal and love can be spiritual, and that in itself is the journey that runs through the whole of the Divine Comedy. And this is the carnal bit of love. And these are two young lovers who have come together. He, in fact, is her brother-in-law, and at a certain point they have come together, well, as she goes on to tell you, over something they've read, and something they've read has tipped them into sin. But I think what's particularly upsetting about it, and he does this again and again, is she is still feeling the love. So she's both understanding that she's in agony because of the sin, but she's still feeling the sin. So the repentance goes on and on and on, and she can never repent enough to somehow round the circle.
Absolutely. And this word amor just keeps coming up, and there are these uses of it in threes, and the third use of it, she says that love brought us to one death, they die together. And in the Italian, you have amor and una morte, so amor is embraced by death.
So and for eternity, they're together in hell.
Tchaikovsky had been reading this. It's what moved him to write the symphonic poem we'll be listening to later. And you can hear, when you listen to it, the kind of lugubrious descent into hell with Virgil. And then you hear the whirlwind spinning and chromatic. It's an extraordinary piece. And then right at its heart, you can hear Francesca's voice. It's a clarinet solo, which leads into the kind of calm and melancholic heart before you're out in the spinning whirlwind again. Let's hear Francesca herself describing the beginning of their love. Peter.
And then I turn to them. Thy dreadful fate, Francesca, makes me weep. It so inspires pity, said I, and grief compassionate. Tell me, in that time of sighing sweet desires, how and by what did love his power disclose and grant you knowledge of your hidden fires? Then she to me, the bitterest woe of woes is to remember in our wretchedness old happy times, and this thy doctor knows. Yet if so dear desire thy heart possess to know that root of love which wrought our fall, I'll be as those who weep and who confess. One day we read for pastime how in thrall Lord Lancelot lay to love who loved the queen. We were alone. We thought no harm at all. As we read on, our eyes met now and then, and to our cheeks the changing color started. But just one moment overcame us when we read of the smile desired of lips long thwarted, such smile by such a lover kissed away. He that may never more from me be parted, trembling all over, kissed my mouth. I say the book was Galotte, the complying ribald who wrote. We read no more that day. While the one spirit thus spoke, the other's crying wailed on me with a sound so lamentable, I swooned for pity like as I were dying, and as a dead man falling down I fell.
Thank you, Peter. Margaret, it is interesting that they're seduced by reading, isn't it?
It's absolutely fascinating. So we actually have Francesca here, and she has almost parroted or in some way embodied this courtly love rhetoric that she knows so well. And here she is now also accusing those who write that way of being panders, of being the people that have brought her to this effect. She's incredibly passive here, of course. It's very, very coy. She's not going to allow that it was her own fault. And she's actually going to start accusing her husband of being the great brute for killing such true lovers.
Well, he did kill them, didn't he?
In a feudal society, he might have had some level of justice on his side, I suppose. She has been treacherous.
How do we make sense of the different loves here? There's the ideal, unconsummated kind of devotion that we know that Dante felt for Beatrice, his great love, whom he met twice, we think, when she was 8 and when she was a young woman. She married somebody else, she died young, she certainly wasn't the person that Dante married. So there's that ideal, there's a religious love with it, there's this consummated love, which is itself in some sense idealized, and there is the straight love of God. But where do these stand in relation to each other?
These were very interconnected, you know, 500 or 600 years ago. The notion was that, and it's funny because you think of Catholicism now and you think it of being so anti the body and so anti-sexual, but the kind of arrival of kind of Neoplatonism in it basically says, well, we learn about how we love on earth, and that's by the first people that we love. And so you can feel very pure love towards somebody that you're deeply attracted to. And there was even the notion that from having physical love, the love of your husband or your wife, you could grow on to begin to understand that purer, more powerful love is available to you. Now, lots of people get stuck on the husband and wife or the brother-in-law love, but there is a sense in which love can emerge through to spiritual rapture, which of course is paradise.
So we could go from the whirlwind, and if we kept going for the 100 cantos and got right to the end in the Paradiso, we'd find the rose, we'd find this beautiful circle of divine light and divine love, and we'd find the love that moves the sun and the stars, the very, very last line. And that's the type of love that you have to go for, not this whirlwind of emotions and of passions.
We've already heard something of Dante's afterlife in the European imagination. We've heard of, you know, Tchaikovsky. We've talked a bit about Botticelli and the way in which the kind of visual tradition of Dante. It was actually in William Blake who really kind of rediscovered Dante for the English poetic imagination. And the English Romantics took the Divine Comedy as one of the founding texts of the Romantic spirit. We're going to listen next to a sonnet from John Keats, who's been reading Dante.
As Hermes once took to his feathers light, when lulled Argus, baffled, swooned and slept, so on a Delphic reed my idle sprite, so played, so charmed, so conquered, so bereft the dragon world of all its 100 eyes, and seeing it asleep, so fled away, not to pure Ida with its snow-cold skies, nor unto Tempe, where Jove grieved a day, but to that second circle of sad hell, where in the gust, the whirlwind, and the flaw of rain and hailstones, lovers need not tell their sorrows. Pale were the sweet lips I saw, pale were the lips I kissed, and fair the form I floated with about that melancholy storm.
Peter, thank you. Margaret, what's Keats finding there in Dante? What excited Blake and Byron and Shelley and Leigh Hunt and everybody?
Well, I suppose most of the Romantic tradition would be to move away from those moral absolutes and to try and enjoy the moment and to enjoy that idea of transience and of human fallibility. That's all there. In that sonnet from Keats, he actually spends the first 8 lines actually admitting that it is adulterous. So the whole Hermes and the whole idea of getting rid of the guardian in order that you can enjoy this embrace. It's actually a dream that he had. And he writes a letter to his brother about it, and he says that it was the most fantastic extended period of consummation through kiss, and that although it was a very cold place, he felt quite warm. So, I mean, he's definitely enjoying that idea of passion, and I suppose it's also that idea that human emotions might be in some way transcendent or bringing you to a greater ecstasy, whereas, of course, I suppose the medieval orthodoxy would be that you had to leave behind the carnal and go for some kind of divine sense of transcendence.
So is it that transcendence, Sarah, that appeals so particularly to the Romantic imagination? I mean, Tchaikovsky wasn't the only composer inspired by the story. Is that equally true in the visual arts?
It's certainly transcendence. It's also a touch of melodrama. Mm. You know, let's face it, they love their emotions big and they love their tragedies. And Dante fulfills all of those things. I was thinking when you said rapture, that of course divine rapture, when you look at it throughout a medieval period, you look at saints, women saints, describing their relationship with God, and it comes very close to eroticism. It comes very close to a human love as well as a divine love. When it comes to the visual imagination, I mean, this is the other place where Dante, because Dante, as you said so brilliantly, Margaret, because Dante actually painted hell with words, he did half the work of the visual artists who then can represent it. And from Botticelli on, you actually see each circle of hell. And then, of course, when the Romantics tip into the Gothic, people like Doré, who illustrates Dante, loves that dark, brooding majesty of hell. You know? And even Blake, many of them start off doing all the illustrations, and because they need to get them all done, they do them in black and white, which suits hell rather well. And in fact, both Blake and Botticelli never managed to finish all the colouring in they would have done in order to give it technicolour.
So does this sensibility get carried forward into the 20th century?
Well, the one that I really love as an example of that is Rodin's The Kiss, which I think has kind of been reproduced so often in 20th century, is this idea of complete reciprocity, the great meeting of bodies, but which was initially his sculptural illustration of Paolo and Francesca. He was going to put it onto the gates of hell, and then he realised that it was actually too positive, it was too much of bliss. And so it doesn't become one of the sculptural forms on the gates of hell, like the Thinker can also be found on the gates of hell. And instead we know it's in marble in the Tate and in other places as this kind of story in its own right, rather than a story that is framed to be part of the second circle. And at least keeps us honest that he knows where he's at.
And I would say, to bring it really up to date, and actually it's going to sound like I'm being populist, but it's a film I truly admire, which is David Fincher's film Seven, which is about the punishment of the seven deadly sins, where what he takes from Dante, although he does it differently, is the notion that for each punishment, for each sin, there is an apposite punishment. So that film opens very powerfully with a corpse being found stuffed because he is a corpse suffering from the sin of gluttony. And when Morgan Freeman actually goes into the main library in New York to try and track down the mind of the killer, he comes across Dante's Inferno, and he comes across illustrations for it. And that's such a clear statement of how this, the power of these images and the power of the density of thought just ripples on through the years.
And I'm afraid that's where we have to leave it for now. Thank you very much indeed to my guests, Sarah Dunant and Margaret Keane, to our reader, Peter Marinka, and to all of you in our audience here at the Royal College of Music, and to our listeners on Radio 3.
Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall, where the members of the Philharmonia Orchestra are making their way back onto the stage to continue this all-Russian programme tonight. Now, in this half, their principal conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, will be leading them in Stravinsky's Petrushka and Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini. And Petrushka was the second of the series of ballets that Stravinsky wrote for the Paris seasons of Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. Choreographed by Fokine, starring Nijinsky, it was the story of a lovesick puppet clown who comes alive and falls in love with the puppet ballerina, but is murdered by his love rival, the puppet Moor. It's all set against the backdrop of the famous Shrovetide Fairs in St. Petersburg, and so the music is awash with Russian folk songs and street cries. The whole piece is colourful, it's quirky, and it's influenced hundreds of film scores and cartoons. And it's seen by Esa-Pekka Salonen as a work of revolutionary genius.
We're talking about a history-changing masterpiece and a piece that, like the other early ballets of his, is unique in the sense that it hasn't aged at all. Everything is alive. Every time I look at this score or conduct it, which has been many, I'm just stunned by the vividness of everything and how the life force in this music is just so stunning. And of course we are being taught in school that the revolutionary piece was The Rite of Spring. But in many ways, Petrushka has elements that are even more avant-garde or groundbreaking. And it's harder to play also. Perhaps the reason is that unless you have solo wind players with a lot of fantasy and imagination and complete control over the instrument, it doesn't come to life. Or it doesn't tell the story as well as it should. With the Philharmonia, we don't have that problem.
They don't indeed. Well, the piece is in four movements. In the first, at the Shrovetide Fair, a showman appears with these three puppets who come alive and perform a Russian dance. Ah, here comes the leader of the Philharmonia. You can hear the applause. That's Zsolt Tihomir Vishontai. He'll be just tuning the orchestra up as I continue to tell you about the structure of Petrushka. As I say, we have that first scene at the Shrovetide Fair, and then we move to poor Petrushka's cell, where he rails against his fate, unrequited love for the ballerina. Then in the third tableau, she dances with the Moor, and when Petrushka appears, there's a fight, and he's thrown out. The finale takes us back to the fairground, where, amongst various Russian stereotypes, there's a peasant with a bear, for example, the Moor chases Petrushka out of the puppet booth and cuts him down with his scimitar. Well, the showman tries to calm the horrified crowd by holding up the sawdust-filled body. It's only a puppet, after all. But then Petrushka's ghost appears, thumbing his nose at his old owner. Well, here comes conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen to conduct Stravinsky's Petrushka. This is the 1947 revised version of the orchestral music for this wonderful ballet.
Thank you. Thank you.
Petrushka, performed by the Philharmonia under Erzsébek Szalonin. The cheer you just heard there was for the trumpet soloist Alan Thomas. There are lots of soloists who could have been picked out, but he got the first cheer, the first nod from his conductor. I think we ought to give special mention to pianist Elizabeth Burley, to Samuel Coles, principal flute, court anglais player Jill Crowther, and actually the second trumpet as well, Alistair Mackey, who just at the end there did that wonderful trumpet duet. And a very appreciative audience once again. Everybody wondering who coughed right at the end, but apart from that, marvellous response. Erzsébek Szalonin returning to the stage to thank his orchestra. This is the 41st time that piece has been played here at Proms. And so on to the Tchaikovsky, a piece of music now that's been described as a symphonic masterpiece of concision, of drama and tenderness. At the suggestion of his brother Modest, Tchaikovsky turned to Dante's Inferno for inspiration and was most taken with the tale of the noblewoman Francesca da Rimini. Born into an aristocratic family from Ravenna, she was married off for political reasons in 1275 to Gianciotto, the deformed second son of the Lord of Rimini. Well, she fell in love with his handsome younger brother, Paolo, but when they were surprised by her husband, Gianciotto killed them both, consigning them, according to Dante, to the second circle of hell, where they were swirled around in a hurricane for all eternity, unable to touch and tortured by memories of the earthly happiness they'd shared. Well, Dante had written this tale centuries before the Romantic movement became obsessed with the notion of ill-fated passion, and while he felt the two lovers thoroughly deserved their fate, Tchaikovsky was decidedly more sympathetic. As he said at the time, "I wrote it with love, and the love has, it seems, turned out pretty well." Well, yes, it did. The critics adored this piece, and Tchaikovsky himself always maintained a very soft spot for it too. Talking to Esa Pekka Salonen earlier, he was commenting how Tchaikovsky always seemed fascinated by strong women. And as this piece was written at a time when the composer was about to enter into a terribly unhappy marriage and was hopelessly conflicted about his homosexuality, perhaps you can see the appeal of a character who broke with convention, who followed her heart, and to hell with the consequences. Well, Esa-Pekka Salonen is returning to the stage now for the performance at tonight's prom of Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini.
Thank you.
swirling around the second circle of hell, the Philharmonia Orchestra playing Tchaikovsky's Francesca da Rimini, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. Fabulous performance, hugely enjoyed here at the Royal Albert Hall and bringing tonight's prom to a close. Particular mention to clarinetist Mark van der Wiel, who played that beautiful theme, Francesca's theme. Esa-Pekka Salonen in his third season as principal conductor and artistic director of the Philharmonia, greatly admired and loved by his musicians. And indeed by the audience here. Wonderful piece of music, that Francesca da Rimini. You know, Sir Henry Wood conducted it at the proms on 24 separate occasions. He was so fond of it. But that does bring us to an end of tonight's prom. Tomorrow we have two here at the Royal Albert Hall, both featuring musical super couple, cellist Matthew Barley and violinist Victoria Mulova. In the first prom at 7 o'clock, they'll be joining the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra under Ivan Volkov for the world premiere of Thomas Lacher's Concerto for Violin, Cello and Orchestra. And then the orchestra will be bringing us Bruckner's Fifth. Then Victoria and Matthew will be back for the late night prom at 10:15 with a handful of their musician pals playing a gypsy-inspired programme based around the Kodály duo for violin and cello, with also Matthew's own work and arrangements there too. So do tune in for that if you can. But now as the cheers and applause continue to echo around the hall and Esa-Pekka Salonen continues to bring his orchestra to their feet, it's time for me to hand you back to Broadcasting House. I hope you've enjoyed the prom. Here's Jill Anderson.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Friday afternoon at 2:20 here on Radio 3. Well, our next programme at 10:15 looks at the post-colonial relationships between ethnic groups in Kenya, and that's followed at 11 by Late Junction with Verity Sharp, music from America and Ukraine and piano music by Chopin. Well, let's hear piano music now by Tchaikovsky. This appropriately is August from the Seasons. Thank you. Lydia Artemu played August from The Seasons, Opus 37A by Tchaikovsky. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. In 2010, 17 African nations celebrated the 50th anniversary of independence from colonial rule. And as the wind of change swept through the continent, the early 60s would see colonial flags lowered all over Africa from west to east and later in the south. The Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul travelled through East Africa in the late 1970s to ask what liberation from colonial rule meant to people then, almost two decades on. And now on Radio 3, we've another chance to hear North of South Revisited, in which the Ugandan journalist Joel Kibazo retraces Naipaul's journey to see how much has changed in the last 30 years.
An introduction can turn so easily into a self-justifying exercise, a kind of special pleading on behalf of a book whose nature and purpose might so easily be misunderstood, especially a book about Africa, a subject that in the ex-imperial West is labelled fragile, handle with care.
The Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul travelled through East Africa in the late 1970s. His book, North of South, has been described as one of the best travel books of all time.
I will repeat here the letter I wrote to my English publisher when the idea of my undertaking an African journey was first discussed. Of course, I wrote, it is impossible to be precise about the end product, if for no other reason than that the kind of book one eventually writes will be determined by the kind of experiences one has actually had. The idea is that I shall travel in East Africa for a period of, say, 5 or 6 months, visiting Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia.
Naipaul's portrait of Africa is engaging, often controversial and humorous, as he reflected on the people he met on his journey and sought to understand how wide the gap was between what he called the rhetoric of liberation and its day-to-day manifestations.
The book will arise out of my own obsessions. What do terms like liberation, revolution, and socialism actually mean to the people who experience them? How much cynicism is there? How much apathy? How much sheer incomprehension? The answers to such questions, I feel, can be found only by experiencing the heat and dust of the countries themselves. Do the people actually care? What are they like as individuals? Should we despair or should we continue to hope? Beyond all this, but not entirely unconnected with it, is the relationship of black and white and brown.
I'm Joel Kibazo. I'm a Ugandan and a child of the independence generation. As Africa celebrates the 50th anniversary of 17 African nations this year, with others following shortly afterwards, I'll be revisiting those questions posed by Shiva Naipaul. How have things changed since he wrote North of South 3 decades ago?
Don't be afraid to come to Kenya. Oddly enough, one of the cheapest ways of getting from London to Nairobi is to travel from Brussels via Kinshasa on Air Zaire. There is no need to worry, the travel agent had said when I expressed anxiety at the news that he had booked me on a flight on the Congolese National Airline. They have good planes, flown by white pilots.
Starting in Kenya, which gained independence from Britain in 1963, I'll be retracing Naipaul's journey through East Africa to find out what the language of liberation means to the citizens of today, most of whom are under 30 and have no experience of colonialism or the heady days leading up to independence.
The weather conditions here for departure are good. No problems for the flight.
Through a break in the clouds, Lake Victoria flashed blue. Then, magically, we were out of the clouds and sailing in sunshine. The uplands of East Africa spread out below us. The luggage belt ceased its clattering. My luggage had not come off the plane. The customs officer looked at his gold watch. Our baggage hasn't come off the plane, I said. The officer called over a khaki-clad official. They say their luggage hasn't come off their plane. That's not our responsibility, the khaki-clad man said. Whose responsibility is it? It is the airline's responsibility. What airline did you come by? Air Zaire. He looked at me pityingly. That is bad, he said. You may as well forget all about it. You can buy new clothes, the khaki-clad man said. You Asians are rich people. However, he went away and returned with two forms. You can fill these in if you want to, he said. It is important to remember that it is not an admission of liability. Guarantees you nothing, the first official emphasized, gazing fondly at his watch. It must have been a very recent acquisition. A week later, my suitcase did miraculously turn up, minus my transistor radio and a number of lesser items.
Just arrived in Nairobi, and thank goodness my bags have arrived. Looking around, this is an airport that has hardly changed since Naipaul's days.
At the turn of the century, Nairobi could hardly be said to exist. In 1913, it consisted of little more than the railroad, a network of dusty lanes, a hotel or two, and a ramshackle Indian bazaar. A mile or two beyond the Norfolk Hotel, the wilderness began.
Today, Nairobi is one of the fastest-growing cities in Africa. As rural people pour into the city in search of jobs and opportunities, the population has exploded to an estimated 4 million, a large proportion living in the slums that encircle the city.
It was mid-morning, and the open-air pavement attached to the new Stanley Hotel was crowded with tourists dressed for Africa. Bush shirts and sun hats were everywhere in evidence. Cameras and binoculars dangled from sun-tanned necks. German, French, and American voices rang in the air. The smell of safari, of tented bush, of elephant, of hippopotamus, of lion suffused the bright morning. Noisy traffic choked the broad expanse of Kenyatta Avenue. Fashionably dressed blacks streamed along the pavements, the men carrying briefcases, the women swinging handbags. Nairobi vibrated with cosmopolitan splendor. A crippled beggar, his hands encased in sandals, crawled nimbly on the periphery of the terrace. Jambo, Jambo. My shoeshine boy was not a boy at all. He was a gray-headed, roomy-eyed Kikuyu. What are your charges? He waved his arm airily. Don't worry about charge. But I do worry. He sighed. It was as though I had caused him profound spiritual pain. Worry's no good for the heart. I ask reasonable price. No need to worry. He produced a bottle containing a yellowish liquid and smelling faintly of kerosene. This he applied liberally, rubbing it in with vigor. Special ingredient, he said. Highly secret formula. I started to feel uneasy. I should have insisted on settling what the price would be before allowing him to start. I don't want any special ingredient, I said. Just ordinary polish. Too late now, he said cheerfully. He explained that the treatment he was giving me would make any further polishing unnecessary for one whole year. This is the Luke special I give you. I withdrew my foot completely. The kerosene-soaked leather had gone dull and blotchy. He watched me composedly. You cannot meet your friends with your shoes looking like that. I saw his point. I surrendered my feet to him. No more secret ingredients and formulas, just polish. You are a hard man to please, Bwana. With swift dispatch, he polished and shined, coaxing out an indifferent gleam from the damaged leather. It would have to do. I held out 5 shillings, thinking myself more than generous in the circumstances. He laughed the way one laughs at obvious absurdity. Bwana, Werner. Are you trying to tell me that you expect to be paid more than 5 shillings for destroying my shoes? He nodded. How much? 60 shillings, Buana. At the current rate of exchange, 60 shillings was almost £5 sterling. But the Kikuyu, I soon discovered, was not joking. You had the deluxe special for 80 shillings, but well, he looked furtively at my shoes. I gave you the skunk price.
We're now in downtown Nairobi, and it's packed, and the traffic is absolutely incredible. And it really is one hell of a crowded city. John, you've been a driver in the middle of Nairobi for, what, 10 years?
For the last 10 years.
And how has it changed?
Every year you see new cars on the road, and there's lots of cars, and also the old cars, you still see them on the road. Like now, we are driving on a very old car, 1986. So it's still back on the road, and new cars are coming in every day and every month on the same roads.
And it takes quite a while just to get a short distance, doesn't it?
Exactly, yes. Like now, less than 2 kilometers. It has already taken us about half an hour.
Would you call this a sign of development?
Yeah, it is, because, and also the people, you know, even people, they come in every year looking for work. All these people are looking for work. Some are working, some are idle. It's terrible.
Mayor Wangi is a young Kenyan novelist. Ben is the anti-hero of his novel, Going Down River Road. His world is relentlessly urban. His city is universal. The unswept streets, the smoke-filled bars, the whores. As presented, Ben is not merely detribalized, but drained clean of any memory of tribal existence.
But the post-election violence in early 2008 shows that was far from the case.
A move aimed at unifying the country after the violence that killed well over 1,000 people following disputed elections in December.
Urbanization and modernity had not erased ethnic identity or resentments.
In Kibera, people started running everywhere, the flames of fire everywhere. There were one tribe against another tribe.
We lost our innocence, still young and innocent. Nikitish revolution, we silenced by violence. At an early age, I suffered from the hip-hop fever. Then ghetto life transformed me into a revolution diva.
This sense of peoples having lost touch with reality arises whenever one contemplates the lusts that disfigure African societies. The land grab that has followed Uhuru, the slaughtering of elephants for the ivory trade, the tales of bribery, embezzlement, extortion and corruption that daily fill the pages of the nation, signal a collapse of self-control verging on collective derangement.
Looking at the newspapers today, they're full of stories about Kenyan MPs demanding an increase in their salaries that will make them one of the highest paid representatives in the world.
I'm in a taxi in Nairobi, and I thought I'd ask our taxi driver what he thinks about the pay rise that members of parliament are asking for.
As a Kenyan, to my own personal view, if you compare our standard person's wage and the MP's wage, it is incomparable, but still they want their more money. So to us Kenyans, it's a rip-off. The corruption in our country will not take us anywhere.
What do you think the answer is to corruption?
Reducing poverty in our country. That is only when we shall get control of corruption in our country. I think Kenyans, we got independence when we are not ready for it.
Why do you say that?
What I mean is this. Well-off families still remain well-off since before independence. They don't give room for any other common person to upgrade himself.
So in your view, in the nearly 50 years that Kenya has been independent, you don't think much has changed?
Much hasn't said to a common person. It's only changing to the rich families. That's all.
It has all happened before. At the height of the slave trade, the African rulers seem literally to have gone mad. To get hold of the guns and tobacco and brandy they craved, some chiefs betrayed and enslaved their own people. The desire to possess has spiraled out of control. Their successors behave no differently. It is no accident that Uhuru is thought of as a fruit, something to be eaten, something to grow fat on. Progress has been confused with possession.
As an African reading Naipaul's North of South 30 years after it was written, I'm often surprised how shallow and condescending some of its observations are. While some of his reflections are on the button, there is much I do not recognize from my childhood growing up during that time.
The European starts with an immense advantage. The African's longing to be absorbed, to lose himself in the white man's world. Out of this has been forged the black-white alliance in post-Uhuru Kenya. The forgiving and forgetting, between oppressor and oppressed, master and slave, there exist profound psychological bonds. In the spacious, servanted splendor of suburbs like Karen, their privacy guarded by thick hedges and malevolent Alsatians, expatriate life proceeds on its tranquil course.
Hello, how do you do?
We've come to the peaceful suburb of Nairobi called Karen, and it is now more or less part of metropolitan Nairobi. And compared to the time that Shiva Naipaul was writing, things have really changed in the expansion of this city.
Well, I'm Ray Maining. I was born and bred in Britain and came and joined the Survey of Kenya as part of the Colonial Office in 1961 and have remained in Kenya ever since. We, in fact, have lived in the same suburb of Karen since 1966 in the same house. Many years ago, it was still quite rural, and one morning, just after 1 o'clock in the morning, we were woken up by our horses galloping around the property, and then a grunt and a roar, and we went down to see what had happened, with luckily a very powerful torch, to find that these two lionesses had killed one of our horses. The only thing that wakes us up in the middle of the night these days is a very loud disco and bar only a few hundred metres away, which goes on sadly to about 3 o'clock in the morning.
What kept you here? You came in the colonial service and yet you chose to stay in what was to become modern Kenya. Why did you do that?
Every time we go back to Britain, we found that Britain had changed and it's going to an alien country, and eventually decided that we would stay in Kenya, and in the last few years we've become Kenya citizens and we have put our soul and heart into staying in the country.
Are you positive about the future for Kenya?
I am positive, I think, yes. I think the issue of land could be a very, very problematic issue in the future, because it seems inherent that you must own land if you're an average Kenyan. And I, in fact, worked with the Survey Department for 20 years, and one of my jobs was to map the settlement schemes that were in operation at that time in the mid-1960s, where the British government acquired vast amounts of the land owned by European settlers and was then dividing it up into 20-acre plots for allocation to the landless Kenyans. But I've realised that it is very, very difficult and involves a lot of arguments and a lot of controversy about land ownership. And I feel until the issue of land is resolved, there will still be problems.
The ridges of the Kikuyu country stretched away on all sides. Where the land was cut away to accommodate the passage of the road, its red heart was exposed to view. Looking at that bloody redness, one sensed not only the richness of the land, but more disturbingly, its visceral appeal. It seemed to symbolize the Kikuyu's fierce attachment to it, the unity of soil and tribe. It is the soil that feeds the child through lifetime, and again after death, It is the soil that nurses the spirits of the dead for eternity. Thus, the earth is the most sacred thing above all. An everlasting oath is to swear by the earth. Those oaths were to surface in a more murderous form during the Mau Mau insurrection.
The Blue Post Hotel is an old-style colonial building put up in 1937. Here with me is John Kamau, a journalist on The Nation newspaper. John, you've done an extensive study on what happened to the land following independence.
What I found out from the archives is that there was some funding from the colonial corporation, which was to fund the buying of the white farmers' land so that it can be given to the black farmers, the new farmers who are to take over the land. But what happened is that a lot of land ended up with the politicians because they knew how to access the loans from the banks. The poor farmers, they could not know how to access this money. So the new ruling class got the best land. They still have it. And that is why we are having so many squatters, people without land. And the land question is still there.
Do you think that those early actions still have an impact today?
Yes, they still have an impact because we still have Kenyans without land. It is what is creating all this conflict, given that the population is rising. It is still a burning issue.
How do you feel about Kenya's prospects? Are you optimistic?
I'm very optimistic. I think we are having a new generation with education and a lot of information. We have not lost hope yet. We went to the brink, we survived. Kenyans are now looking forward to a new constitution, which is quite different from the Lancaster one. It has taken us 20 years to negotiate for that constitution. So there is hope.
My name is Gunjiri Wambogo. I'm the convener of a group called Kikuyus for Change. It's a lobby group that was formed in 2008, immediately after the post-election violence in 2007. There was an intense amount of animosity towards members of the Kikuyu community within Kenya. For those of us who were born after independence, we really did not understand where this was coming from, and we felt it was important to actually provoke a conversation about ethnicity, because we've gone around since independence never really talking about ethnicity. How do we get to a point in a country where one community is going to attack another community purely because they come from two different perspectives? They have no other difference apart from the fact that I'm Kikuyu and you're Maasai or you're Kalenjin or you're Luo.
So do you think your kind of grouping can change this?
There must be a way of engaging in trying to figure out how to go around this. And initially, we were just looking within ourselves as Kikuyus. We said, let's find out what happened to get us to the point where other people would actually point fingers at us as a problem. So we started having conversation now with other communities. And gradually, we started realizing that one of the problems we were having about tribalism is because nobody ever talked about it across tribes. Once you talk about tribalism, it stops being the elephant in the room. And people realize that it's not about getting people in power, it's about institutions. People will realize that different communities can actually coexist without having conflict. We can do this because we've got a generation that is actually able to go beyond communities if we put our minds to it.
In East Africa, the obsessive concern with wildlife leads insidiously to the degradation of the human population. In the eyes of the beholder, the more backward tribes become mere adjuncts to the animals. Indeed, they are often treated, if they are sufficiently exotic and sufficiently primitive, as their equivalents. Ochre-painted Maasai compete for attention with snarling lions. Both in their natural state are regarded as endangered species, which must be preserved for the amusement and instruction of future generations.
My name is Pius Olekoyendo. I'm a Maasai from the local community here.
What I like you to see, the dressing of the Maasai ladies. You can see the prestigious wedding necklaces. The blue color is a righteous color. The Maasai goat live in the blue sky, so the blue color is a righteous color, along with the red color.
I've traveled 5 hours north of Nairobi, driving past Mount Kenya on a rather potholed road to arrive here at Lewa, a 40,000-acre wildlife conservancy.
My name's Ian Craig. I was born in Kenya.
My mother was born in Kenya. She's 18 years old now. And Lewa was the first private sector, not-for-profit conservancy in the country. We focused on wildlife as a source of economic use of this land.
The white community had a particular, shall we say, affinity with the land, many having come as settlers. But you seem to have done something different, taken a slightly different route in terms of how your family has chosen to use the land.
You know, although I'm white, I'm born here. I see Kenya as my land. I proudly hold a Kenya passport. And I obviously inherited the land. And you know, I would hope that as a family we've acted responsibly with that inheritance. Because of wildlife, because of the nature of wildlife, because wildlife needs to move, and we're talking, you know, thousands of elephant, 8,000 elephant in this area of northern Kenya, we needed to work with our neighbours. You couldn't succeed with wildlife in isolation, living within your fence. And we've engaged with communities for wildlife to have an economic value within those communities.
You talk about an economic value. What exactly do you mean?
You have to recognise that northern Kenya has been a backwater in terms of investment. We're only just getting electricity, tarmac roads, new airfields as part of Kenya's Vision 2030. So job opportunities were nil. Insecurity was rampant. It wasn't a place where tourists could come with any level of security to bring their family. Through wildlife, we've been able to build a sort of mosaic of stabilising this area. And now we've got over 1,500 people employed through conservation. There's over $12 million of annual operating costs coming into these different conservancies. It's given tourist investors a level of confidence to build camps and lodges in these areas. Now that generates income that goes back into the communities, back to the landowners. So there's a whole sort of economic dynamic that's grown from animals. It's been an extraordinary catalyst of change in northern Kenya. You know, I'd like you to go and speak to some of our Maasai neighbours to see Ilungwezi. There's a whole new economy developing here based on wildlife.
Welcome to Ilungwezi. I'm James Olekinyaga. I'm the host of the Ilungwezi Lodge. We opened the lodge early 1996 and we have been very, very successful.
There's a community meeting going on in the background.
Ilungwezi was the first community-owned and managed conservation area in Kenya. A Maasai community came together. They received funding from donor agencies to build the top-end tourist lodge. They managed it themselves. And they managed the conservation area to protect the wildlife, and it flourished. It's been replicated time and time again throughout Kenya, and indeed throughout East Africa and other parts of Africa.
We've been joined now by two community leaders who've just come out of the community meeting to have a word with us.
Mzee Kortol said that he has three wives and he has over 20 children. And all the kids are in school now.
Mzee, you've lived a long time. So how do you view this new arrangement of the land in this area?
Mzee Kortol said that he really appreciates that we have the new arrangement, because the money we generate to help in communities around socially. Currently, we are seeing our children benefiting out of the bursaries from the conservation. We have water infrastructures in place. We have seen the improvement of healthcare through the conservation. And you can talk to any white person. So there is now a more strong relationship than 50 years ago.
There will always be a place for white men in this country, Eric said. Everyone thought I was mad when I decided to stay on after independence. They all prophesied doom and disaster. It was a gamble, I admit. But I had a feeling that for those whites who stayed behind, life would get not worse, but better. Uhuru, he foresaw, would bring a rapid expansion of the black middle class. These people would want their children to receive a true blue education.
That was his opportunity. Immediately after Uhuru, he went into private practice, opening up his own educational establishment, which he ran on strictly English lines. He did not employ a single black teacher in any of his schools, the result of deliberate policy. His clients were buying an English education. They did not want to be taught by blacks. If you learn how to think black, Eric said, there's a killing to be made in this country.
My name is Doreen Maynink. I'm head teacher of a secondary school in Nairobi, and I've taught all my life in Kenyan schools. I came to Kenya with my husband in 1961. I wasn't employed as an expatriate teacher. I was employed as a local teacher in every school that I've been in. And now I'm headmistress of a school where I'm actually the only European employed.
Now, in Shivanaipal's book, he meets somebody setting up a school. One of them says, you know, what a black person wants is a British foreign education.
There is an element of truth in it. Not because it's British foreign education. Kenyan people want a good education. They want their children to do well. Now, that maybe does bear out what Naipaul found out or in this interview with this man called Eric. And I've got a feeling Eric went on and did exactly what he said he was going to do and founded several schools around East Africa.
So when the person that Naipaul is talking to says, if you learn how to think black, there's a killing to be made in this country.
Well, I've never made a killing.
Have you learned how to think black?
I wouldn't know what that meant. Our brains surely are no colour. I mean, we've all got the same brain. I would like to think that the people I work with, especially the person who owns my school, who employs me, has become my very good friend. I've worked with her for 18 years. And we have a lot in common. I don't see her thinking black, me thinking white. We've got different ideas about some things, but it doesn't feel black or white.
You've been involved in education for nearly 50 years in this country, and you've seen the changes, but you've also seen the explosion in terms of population and the numbers going to school, going on to higher education. Do you think it's done something for Kenya?
Yes, there are many more well-educated people in this country. This feeling that you're investing in your children when you give them an education, I think is fantastic. I've seen young people change in the 50 years that I've been in teaching. I've seen them embrace new technology much better than I do. I've seen them embrace some of the things that I wish they wouldn't, as far as the West is concerned. But they are so worldly wise. They know what's going on in the world nowadays. As far as they're concerned, it is a global village. And those children have got fantastic potential.
As is the case all over East and Central Africa, it is not the whites who arouse the greatest animosity, but the Asians. Asian women were accused of harboring feelings of superiority because they did not sleep with or marry African men. Asian businessmen, predictably enough, were guilty of monopolizing the distributive trades and exploiting innocent Africans. Not many days after I had arrived in Nairobi, I was treated to a modest display of the Africans' deep resentment of the Asian. An Asian friend came for me in his car, which he parked in the vicinity of the taxi stand. As I was stepping in, one of the taxi drivers, put out by being deprived of a fare, came rushing over and banged on the window. That's the trouble with you Asians. You want to keep Africans poor. You want it all for yourselves. I was a little shaken by this outburst. Ashraf, though, appeared unperturbed. It's one of the reasons why I hardly use a Benz. An Asian in a big car is asking for trouble. But if you look around, you'll see that most of our people still haven't got the message.
My name is Aurelio Ribello. I'm a Kenyan. I was born in Nairobi a long time ago. I was born into colonial Kenya. In colonial times, we had very strict segregation of the races. So independence brought a tremendous change. We put an end to the racial structure of the country. People were able to move freely between the races. There was tremendous opportunity created with the overthrow of the colonial system.
One of the aspects that runs right through the book, North or South by Shivanaipaul, is the distinction between Kenyans of Asian background and Kenyans of African background. And in fact, he says, the two do not mix, are unlikely to mix. Now, what has been your experience?
At the time of independence, the Indians were a large community. Those who could not compromise, who do not want to live with the new structures, packed up and went. Those of us who stayed on, we took a decision that this was our home, this was our country, and we were not going to go anywhere. There are probably about 70,000 of us.
My name is Rasna Wara. I'm a Kenyan citizen, however, I'm not black. I'm a fourth generation Asian. I was born here into a Sikh family in 1962. Just a year before Kenya achieved its independence. In his book, North of South, the late Shivanaipaul, when he came to Kenya, tried to understand why Asians were not integrating with Africans. And he, in his book, he says, the African, if he wishes to, he can dress like a European, he can talk like a European, he can gain entry into European clubs, he can have European ideas, he can cultivate Western mannerisms, but he can never be Asianized in the same way. And for him, that was one of the reasons why there was this hostility between Asians and Africans, because they just didn't understand each other's culture and had no desire to adopt each other's culture either. So if you cannot aspire to be like them, then you're not going to integrate. That was his point, that you have to aspire to want to be like each other. You have to admire certain things in each other's cultures, and only then you can work towards integration.
Ashraf was pessimistic about the future. One day we'll have to pack up and leave, if that is, they give us a chance to pack up. He talked about Uganda, of how traumatic an experience it had been for Asians everywhere. Uganda had totally destroyed any hope of a long-term future in Africa for the Asian. The local blacks had regarded Amin as a hero.
I was a child, I think I was barely 10 years old, when Idi Amin decided to expel Asians from Uganda.
They have been milking the economy of the country.
I have a vivid memory of it because my father took me with him when he went to the railway station to see all the Asians arriving from Kampala on the trains. When I look back now, I find it's rather ironic because the ancestors of these very Asians built that very railway line. And now they were being brought back on that railway line and being expelled from that country, which they helped build.
Whole books have been written about race relations in Kenya that neglect, except as a more or less complicating factor, the Asian population. The assumption has always been that it is only the relationship between black and white that really matters.
For Naipaul, Kenya was another South Africa. He called his book North of South because north of South Africa, Kenya was closest to South Africa. And I think he was right because the separation of the races in Kenya is as visible and as oppressive as it probably was under apartheid. It's not publicly acknowledged because it's very unfashionable to say it. And Kenyatta also used to publicly proclaim Kenya as a multiracial country which had harmonious relations between all the races. But scratch the surface and there is rage. I think that as long as you keep on defining yourself as a race or a tribe or a religion or any other group, there is no hope. And I see that in Kenya, tribe, race,